This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor of the show and that's our good friends at Jam Software. We will tell you more about them as the show. Bradley, big week.
Big week and a terrible week for us to take off. We were off last week due to me being on spring break, but we've also had a chance to digest the information more. So sometimes we don't claim to be a news organization here, so this is an opinion. Nope. So we have more evolved opinions about some of the spring updates from our friends at the fruit stand.
We are definitely more columnists than reporters, aren't we?
Yes, that is true. So one of the things, the big news that happened over the break was Apple has released a new 9.7-inch iPad. And obviously, like, we're doing this series on reasons to deploy devices, and this really, to me... and we'll get into the nuts of it, goes straight at the Chromebook argument for price.
Yeah, technically speaking, this iPad, and people are not sure how to refer to it, this is technically the iPad 5th generation. So this is kind of like, not exactly the successor, but you had the first, second, third, fourth generation iPads, then you had the Air and the Air 2, and then the Pros came along, and now this one is kind of tacked on to the fourth generation iPad, the second Retina iPad that we had. So it's technically called the fifth generation iPad, which is important if you're looking at things like, for example, the out-of-warranty repair costs. It's in a different price bracket from the Pros. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I discovered that today. It's quite a relevant point to look at. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting iPad. It's hardware-wise, you could look at it one of two ways, right? You could look at it as being a speed-bumped iPad Air, or you could look at it like a feature-dumped iPad Pro. And I think I prefer to kind of see it glass half full, if you like, that it's a great device at a great price. And I think the key thing for me, Bradley, is that this is a device that on which everything is supported, right? So if you think about schools and what they kind of have right now, a lot of schools are going back to iPad 2, third generation, fourth generation iPad. These are the iPads that we kind of finished with last year. And a lot of those devices, all of those devices can't support all the features, right? So even up to the iPad Air, you still don't get support for split view in the iPad Air. And, you know, some of those devices are not 64 bits. So you can't run, for example, Swift Playgrounds, which requires 64-bit processor. But the key thing about this, the fifth generation iPad, is that it is fully supported with all software features, including multitasking, split screen, Swift Playgrounds, shared iPad, all the new stuff, right? And I think one of the sort of issues with the older stock of iPads that schools have is that they're really living in a kind of, you know, 3 or 4 year ago world in terms of software, because the hardware they've got doesn't support all the new and current software features, and now this device does. So that's kind of big picture. I think that's kind of what this device is really about, is it's about getting schools in particular, but it's also available for everybody, getting schools onto current iPad software and current requirements. So that's and for that thing, it does a fantastic job, I think.
Yeah, it includes an A9 processor, where the iPad Pros use an A9X. The thing you need to keep in mind here is, really, to me, once we hit like A8, the mm-hmm. iPads never felt slow due to hardware reasons. Like, the things that iPads struggled with were software wise, and so we have at this maturity point where, I mean, yes, on paper the iPad Pro is obviously a lot faster. And if you're maxing it out, then you can notice. But this is no different than where we are with the Mac today, to where, I mean, I've got, you know, a 3-year-old MacBook Air at home that still runs great. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so, yes, it's not like if you're video editing or you're doing, if you're doing things that take advantage of something that a MacBook Pro or a 5K iMac would do, yes, you'll notice. But for the average user, you might not even notice.
I think the big difference between the A9X and the A9 is graphics performance. It's not actually CPU. The CPU difference will be barely perceptible to anybody except the most hardcore nerd. The graphics performance, I think for the people and the purposes that this device is targeted at, I think it's fine, right? The way I look at it is that the key graphics performance component on the iPad Pro is probably to do with processing pixels fast enough that you can keep up with a pencil. and that you can maintain the illusion that the pencil is actually drawing on the screen. And those devices do a great job of that. If you look at Apple's spec page, the speed bumps are all described as multiples of the A8 processor, right? So the iPad 5th generation gets about a 1.7, I think it is, I'm doing this from memory, but about a 1.7x improvement in CPU and about a 1.8x improvement in graphics, whereas the A9X gets about a 1.9x improvement in CPU, but a 2.6x improvement in graphics. So the fifth generation iPad doesn't go as far in graphics performance as the A9X does, but the CPU is roughly comparable. It's a wee bit slower, but that could be just even to do with CPU frequency rather than anything else. So very, very fast and capable device. Not the perhaps best device for the absolute highest end tasks, but I think for what the people who are going to buy that want it for, perfectly good iPad for almost every purpose.
Yes, and great storage sizes. They've obviously canned 16 gig, and that would have been, that would have been
laughable.
But I could, you could see a world where that happens. So we start at 32 gig. You can upgrade to 128 gig, and I think 32 gig for most intents and purposes will serve a lot of people fine for 1-to-1.
Yeah, so I really think that Apple is very clearly guiding people down one of two paths, right? So if I look at this as a school purchase, if I'm going 1-to-1, I'm going 32 gigs, right? I mean, last year, that's what we did for our Pros. Our 9.7 Pros are all 32 gig models. That's fine, right? 128 gig, to me, that's a great shared iPad device, right? So you can probably accommodate between 5 and 10 users, depending on the age of the pupil and how much they're doing and so on. But I would say certainly you can accommodate 5 to 6 users on a 128 gig iPad, including apps. And I think if you then sort of divide the cost of that device by 5 or 6, you're looking at a very affordable per pupil cost to deliver a shared iPad experience. So for me, that's kind of the way I look at that, is there's the 1-to-1 device at $299 education. And here's the shared device. Okay, so I think it's $100 more maybe, but then you're amortizing that cost over maybe 5 or 6 different pupils in the class. So you're probably not buying as many, you're spending a bit more, but you're getting a pretty good experience nonetheless.
Yeah, so it's $329 retail for the 32 gig. Schools, you can get it at $299, and that's for a single purchase. You don't have to buy these in bulk to get that rate. It is $299. Fantastic device all around. I mean, it's what I think it is, an answer to Chromebooks, because yes, there are still $199 Chromebooks, but most of those are garbage. I mean, they really are.
All of those are garbage. Yeah.
The Chromebooks really get, like, they're good machines at about $299, maybe even $250. Yep. Find them on sale. So, good move by Apple here with this price cut. And they didn't, it doesn't remind me. Do you remember, like, when you could buy, like, the educational iMacs 5-6 years ago, and they would come, like, in the box, they were starting at 4 gigs, which was laughable. And then the education edition came with 2 gigs, which was embarrassing. And this reminds me.
Yeah, and, like, no remote control and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they just took stuff. It's like, come on. Like, these machines are, like, really unusable. Just because they're going to school doesn't mean they should be terrible. And, like,
it's like a graphics card we found lying around the back of the machine.
Bingo. And again, at the time, 4 gigs was like you upgraded to 8 right away, and they were still with half of that. It's not a dumbed down machine. It's not like they put an A5 in with Retina display or something where it's like embarrassingly slow. It's a great machine, and honestly, I would argue that it's the iPad that most people should buy. Like, even the average, like, if you just said, like, hey, I just want an iPad to watch Netflix on, to read some books, and to browse, like, you don't probably need the iPad Pro unless you want the pencil. Even say, unless you want the absolute fastest, or if you want the pencil, or if you want the 13-inch size, this is the machine to buy.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think looking at what I think it does is it pulls the line apart a little bit, and it very much simplifies the decision about which iPad you're going to get, right? So unless you're really looking at going, like, seriously, I'm going to be all in on iPad, or I'm going to be using it significantly for some very high-end tasks, it's very hard to look at that and say, yeah, I'm going to spend another $170 or even $200 on an iPad, just getting up to the iPad Pro capacities. Now, one of the things about this iPad is that in some ways it's more defined by what it doesn't have than what it does. I mean, it's a perfectly good baseline iPad, but it loses almost everything that made the iPad Pro the iPad Pro in the first place. So it only has the two speaker system, not fours. The cameras are not as good as the 9.7 Pro, but they're exactly the same as the 12.9 Pro. As you know, the 12.9 Pro has got slightly older generation cameras. So the fifth generation iPad has 8 megapixels on the back and 1.2 on the front, whereas the 9.7 Pro is 12 megapixels on the back and 5 on the front. So it doesn't quite get that, you know, iPhone 6S generation camera. It's got an older generation camera, but, you know, for photography on a tablet, that's probably fine. Worth the trade-off. The other thing it doesn't have, Bradley, is it doesn't have that laminated True Tone display that the 9.7 Pro has got. It's a non-laminated screen, which means there's going to be a little air gap in between. So it's basically iPad Air class screen technology rather than the latest stuff they've got in the Pro. Now, that might be relevant and interesting because one of the things I noticed looking at Apple's support site today was that, you know, the out-of-warranty service charge that you pay if you drop and smash it, that is significantly less for this device than it is for the Pro. The Pro is something like $379 for the 9.7 Pro, and this one I think is $239, something like that, which somebody on Twitter pointed out to me, well, at that price, you might as well just buy yourself a new iPad. I mean, if the device is $299 for one, and you're looking at paying $239 or whatever it is for a repair, you know, why would you not just buy a new iPad? You know, so that's getting a bit weird at that point. But it does still have it's less than the repair cost of the iPad Pro. That's for sure. So yeah, no True Tone and no Smart Connector, no Apple Pencil either.
Does the 12.9 inch iPad have the True Tone display?
No. Okay. No, it doesn't. It's only the 9.7. That is the absolute leading edge of iPad technology right now. In cameras, in display, the 9.7 is the best.
At this price point, at this feature set, like you said, to me, unless you want pencil support on 9.7 or the keyboard support with the smart connector, or if you want the 12.9, this is the iPad to buy. I mean, and it's not even, again, if they sold 16 gigabyte at $329 and it's $429 for a usable one, like, okay, we'll have a different discussion. But like $329 out the door retail, $299 education, that's a great machine. That's a great machine.
Yeah. I mean, my only slight complaint is that it doesn't support the Apple Pencil because, you know, we're finding we've got about 10% of our kids now have got an Apple Pencil. They've purchased their own Apple Pencil to bring to school, and I see them using it a lot in school. So that would have been something that would have been nice to get in there, but, you know, that is a high-end screen technology, you know, increased refresh rates, you know, probably got to be a laminated display to get the parallax error down. So I can understand why it's not, but I'm hoping that in a couple of years' time, we might see a device like this, maybe the sixth generation iPad. Maybe it still doesn't have True Tone, maybe it still doesn't have four speakers and the smart connector, but at least has a screen that supports the Apple Pencil. That would be really nice to see.
Or just like the old days, maybe it supports it and they'll sell an enabler for $499. So what we're talking about
Sir Ben's Oxley is gone, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a... when there was a transition to 802.11g to N, some of these, I don't even know why they didn't come with N out of the box, but like there was these Macs that had 11N that were only rated for 11G, and you'd have to buy like a $5 app to update it to 11N. It was weird. So yeah, some sort of software.
Yeah, it was because the 11N standard had not been ratified when they shipped those devices, so they had to put in the final spec firmware as an updater, but because of the Sarbanes-Oxley law, they weren't allowed to do it for nothing. Because post Enron, you had to make sure that everything you sold, you accounted for at the time you sold it. So you had to, and it was the same thing when Apple also used to charge $5 for iPod Touch software updates because they weren't accounting for that cost over time. So fortunately, all that is gone now. That was a lot of nonsense.
Yes, it was. I see no problems being this. This is the iPad I recommend. Any school that asks. Just no qualms about it. To me, it's in a lot of ways, it's like the MacBook Air. I mean, obviously that's not the best computer on the market, but there are a lot of things. It's the machine. This is the machine you buy in bulk, or if you're just a regular non-power user, you don't care about the latest and greatest kind of thing. I'm not really seeing a lot of downsides here, and other than just like wants that don't fit this price point.
Yeah. There's no obvious drawback at all for the kind of markets and uses that it's targeted to. And I think that's important to understand. It's not a bleeding edge, new high-end technology iPad. It's It's just a mass market, mass purchase iPad that you can buy in the hundreds, and it will serve you very well for a good few years to come. And I think I was talking to one of my friends, Andrew Jewell from iTeach, and he was saying that we were chatting over on Friday night over pizza, and we worked out that if you were a school who were trying to deliver like a shared iPad experience for your schools, that you could do a sort of one between five or one between six shared iPad deployment with this device, and it would cost you something, including an MDM license, it would cost you on the order of 70 pence per pupil per week to put a fully supported brand new 64-bit iPad into the classroom that students could share through shared iPad. And I'm thinking, you know, I feel as a civilization we can probably afford that for every school pupil, so what's holding us back?
Before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for tonight. Jamf Pro is a solution for deploying, managing, and securing all these iPads that you're buying or any Apple device. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamf every day. You can bring learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classroom. Start a free trial of Jamf at jamf.com. That's JAMF.com. And they did have, I would say, day negative zero support for iOS 10.3 and all those new Apple software updates, because they came out with support for it the day before they launched. So kudos to them for having that ready to go. But check out Jamf at jamf.com.
Yeah, I definitely be spending quite a bit of time in my Jamf Pro this week just trying to get things updated. I went for a big push to try and get as many devices as I could updated to 10.2.1 before we went to 10.3. I had no knowledge that 10.3 was coming out quite as soon as this. I sort of assumed April, but because of the file system transition, which we'll talk about in a minute, I wanted to try and get as close. I found one or two kids in our school who were still running 10.0.1. I was like, "What are you people doing? why have you not pressed this button in like since November?" So I at least got them up to a reasonable version. So people are mostly going from 10.2 or 10.21 up to 10.3 rather than going from much, much older versions.
Yeah, that's going to the file system change is going to be a big one. So let's talk about iOS 10.3 and Apple Classroom 2.0. These did ship this week, as we mentioned, and then one of the things this does add is support for the new MDM commands for the Apple TV, which we kind of alluded to a few weeks ago. But there's a lot of good stuff there if you're looking to deploy Apple TVs en masse.
Yeah, I think that's probably a show in itself, you know, getting up to speed on Apple TV as an actual full peer of iOS in your management system. I need to use that as an excuse to buy one under our device enrollment so that we can sort that out. But I might do that over the next little while.
So yeah, APFS is the new file system. Honestly, kind of crazy. They updated tens of million devices like over the air, and really no major, you know, APFS gate stories. I know the updates take a little bit longer, but I mean, kudos to the team there at Apple that did that.
Yep. No, that seems to have gone fine. I've not heard a single report from anybody that something went badly wrong. But of course, as usual, back up before you go.
So lots of new MDM commands in iOS 10.3. Again, this is assuming your MDM provider supports that, but they are built in.
Important to specify here, Bradley, that these are MDM commands, right? So these are ways that an MDM server can talk to a device. That doesn't necessarily mean that your MDM vendor has actually implemented any of them. And of course, that has been one of the issues with Apple Classroom, which we'll talk about in a while, is that many MDM vendors simply didn't implement support for Apple Classroom at all. So Apple have provided some workarounds. But these are just some of the things that an MDM server in principle can now do with an iPad. And if you run Jamf, some of those things are already supported. Some of them are, even Jamf don't support them yet, at least as far as I can tell so far. But some cool stuff, like you can do remote reboot and shutdown of a device. I was wondering why, but somebody pointed out to me, like, at the end of term or when the summer holidays come, you can just hit a button and shut down every iOS device under your control to save battery and things like that, to save them running completely out of battery before the start of the next term.
Yeah, it's one of those MDM features I never would have thought about, but that's a great, because that is kind of something you don't do, but you'd like to think you would do. Manually,
yeah,
but you're not going to do it.
The next one's a big one, I think, or will be a big one in the future, which is that, do you remember in iOS 10 that there came some features for updating iOS remotely, and we were all really excited about it, and then it didn't quite work the way we wanted to? There have been some loosening of the restrictions. I mean, I think this is perhaps the theme for 10.3, is that some of the requirements have been loosened for several things. Now, it used to be that in iOS 10.2 and earlier, you had to have your devices in device enrollment and supervised in order to remotely update their operating system. Now, in 10.3, you only have to have the devices supervised. They don't have to be in device enrollment, but they do have to be, obviously, MDM enrolled, and they have to be supervised. But with you can now push the operating system commands to those devices as well.
So this would be like if you... you did a BYOD, but then you supervised them through Apple Configurator before you enrolled them into yep. MDM, right? Or if you had an older device that, you know, you bought from Best Buy or something.
There's a couple of other things you can do with update. One is, you know how when you get an iOS update and it says you do remind me later, right? So it says iOS 10.3 is ready and you do remind me later. There's a new MDM command where your MDM can basically put your device into that mode. Now, you still cannot, if your device is passcoded, you still cannot like remotely press a button and the device will just immediately reboot and start installing the OS. But what you can do is you can start the device on this path of annoying the user increasingly frequently until they do press the update button. So you know how when you unlock the device, it says, this software is now ready for update. And then over like a week or so, it just gets a bit more frequent and a bit more frequent to the point where if you keep ignoring it, it just tells you every time you unlock the device. You can now set that train in motion with MDM. It's not clear to me if anybody's implemented that feature yet, but it's something that in principle can be done. So it's, it could be set up for doing it that way in the future.
Yeah, that's I like this loosening up though. I do like that. That seems to be a theme, and it's evolving as you've seen things in real world usage.
Yeah, and I think the thing that what it kind of says to me is that Apple's concerned more now to give everybody access to like the latest techniques for everything, even if they didn't buy it in the approved fashion. You know, so schools that maybe have a lot of devices, but they bought them maybe piecemeal, they bought them from different vendors, stuff like that. Apple wants to kind of bring them all into the fold and have them managing their devices in a correct fashion, whereas previously it was only for the schools that did the kind of golden path of device enrollment through, you know, either Apple or a supported VAR. But now it's just like, if you've got devices and you at least have institutional control so you can supervise, we can now do all these things with them as well.
Yeah.
What else did I discover? This is, tell you just the way I find this stuff, Bradley, is I go to the MDM protocol spec and I go to the configuration profile payload spec and I just search for 10.3 or whatever the new iOS version is. And I just search the document for that because all of these keys and all of these commands, they all say available from iOS 10.3. So if you just search the document for the new version, you can find all the cool stuff that's been added without having to scroll past all the stuff that you already know about. So that's a fun technique for digging into things. What else did I find? Oh, yeah, there's this cool thing on 10.3 called, requires tethered network connection, where any MDM command that is sent to a device can have this flag set, which says this command requires a tethered network connection. And what will happen is that the device will receive it, but it won't actually execute that command or respond to that command until the iPad is plugged into Ethernet. Which is pretty cool, because if you think about it, you might think, well, iPads don't have Ethernet, but if you get the Apple Ethernet to USB adapter, and then you get the USB to Lightning adapter, and you plug that all into a power connection, then when you plug your iPad into that Lightning cable, it will actually get a DHCP address from Ethernet, and it will download stuff over Ethernet. So, one, I don't think this is implemented again yet, even in Jamf, but what you could do is say you had like a really big app installs and weak Wi-Fi and you wanted to push out like Keynote and Pages and Numbers and all of these apps at the same time. What you could do is you could say, your MDM could say, install these apps, but only on Ethernet. And then what you could do is have like a download kiosk or an install kiosk where kids can walk up, plug their iPad into a Lightning cable for 5-10 minutes. And then all these app installs will fire off, presumably quite fast because they're on Ethernet. And then you're done, you know, so the commands are pending, but they're not, they don't execute until you get onto an Ethernet connection.
Yeah. And that would be there. I could see certain situations where you would want to do that, but then, you know, I wouldn't want to see like, you know, download stations all around the campus. You'd be better off to upgrade your Wi-Fi to work and handle that.
Yeah.
But for certain things, like you know, you could see. Now, you wonder, I'm trying to think. No, I was going to say, could they use this at WWDC to push out iOS updates or something on the Ethernet only? But no, probably not.
I don't think only, no, because Apple wouldn't control your MDM.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I was thinking like there's a way, but that, well, I wonder, could you have to install like a profile to get the developer beta, right?
True.
Could, thinking out loud here. That could be.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they could maybe set a key on their profile that says something like, you know, when you're on the beta track, only install it if you're on the Ethernet. But I suspect that would be kind of tricky because what happens when people go home and then they're not on, you know, not everybody's got an Ethernet connection for iOS devices at their house. So not everybody's got an Ethernet connection at their home anymore. That's the other thing. So, I mean, that seems quite cool. And I suppose the other way you could use that is you could use it in like deployment. So if you're, you know, you maybe have like a pathway through your deployment. So when people come into the hall, they pick up their iPad, they go get their Apple ID, they sign in, and then their iPad is configured. And at that point, they're on the Wi-Fi. The MDM will send all the install commands. And then maybe like the last step before you leave is just jack it into this Ethernet connection for 5 minutes and then go away. And you've got the big apps as well. And maybe just on day one, it just takes the load off the Wi-Fi enough that you survive the day.
Yes.
What else? Configuration settings. Only really two that are interesting, or only two at all, apart from the ones to do with Apple Classroom. One is you can block dictation input, so like dictation on the keyboard, you can stop people using that if you want to. And the second one is, this is quite interesting, Bradley, but be careful here. You can enforce that the device only connects to known Wi-Fi networks, right? And by known, I mean Wi-Fi networks that were delivered by a configuration profile. So if you, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation there perhaps, but what you need to do here is you need to make sure that if you push a profile that says only allow it to connect to whitelisted Wi-Fi, in that self-same profile, you have to make sure you push a Wi-Fi profile payload at the same time. Because otherwise, if you do that, if you say only connect to known Wi-Fi and your kids have put in a manual Wi-Fi password, they will be dropped off that network and you'll never be able to reach those devices again. So it's kind of like SSHing into a server. You have to be careful not to lock yourself out by changing the firewall rules or something. This one is something to be a little bit careful about as well.
I guess you'd have to plug into Ethernet for that thing to get new configuration payloads. And the,
I think that's your way out.
Is if you do this, then it, obviously they can't connect at home.
Yeah, so this is the thing. This would only really be appropriate if your devices never went out of school, okay? But what this kind of lets you work around, and this is something that some schools deal with, is kids are like, you know, banding together money and bringing in like a personal Wi-Fi hotspot or connecting to people's phone hotspots. And this would prevent people from doing that with their device. But yeah, if you're going home, that's not really suitable, you know, so it's a very tight restriction, and I can see reasons why people would want to use it, but for a homeschool one-to-one program, it's probably not really appropriate.
Let's see, you got prevent dictation input.
That's more a testing thing, I think, but yeah, still important. Yep. In the new version of macOS, right, there is a little bit of the DNA from caching server, from OS X server. And what this is, right, try and sort of follow this explanation because I'm not entirely sure I'm right in it myself. But let's say you're using like a laptop and MacBook Air to do an Apple configurator-based deployment through a USB hub, right? The usual kind of stuff that we do. What you can now do is there previously was a kind of confusing problem where if you wanted to install big apps over the USB cable, you had to sort of configurator deploy them, and then other apps would come via MDM. So your deployed device had this weird situation where some apps came from configurator, some apps came from MDM, and it was kind of confusing, right? What you can do with tethered caching, though, is you can deliver the big apps over USB, but then iOS thinks that they came from the NDM, right? So it's almost like it kind of transfers ownership of who installed it. But the caching, the tethered caching part is that your Mac can download directly from the store the app binaries and then provide them to each device that you plug in. So you're not constantly downloading them. It's not that you're telling the device to download them over Wi-Fi or anything like that. So this is a kind of a deployment time solution rather than something you would use every day. But if you're setting up a lot of iPads on limited Wi-Fi, you can pull the apps down. And the key thing is this works on any device now, any Mac OS. It's not just Mac OS Server. So that's a nice improvement. It's a little confusing to use right now because you've got to go into the terminal, but I'm sure in the future that will get a bit easier to use.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be built into probably like an app or like caching, you know, or probably built into Apple Configurator.
Yeah, probably. Yep. Okay, what else we got? Apple Classroom 2, right? This is a really big deal. And really, Bradley, I think this is like the number one thing in the whole of the 10.3 release cycle is Apple Classroom 2. So to kind of explain the previous situation, previously you had to have an MDM that supported Apple Classroom. You needed to set up your classes and students in the MDM. It would create what's called an education payload, and it would send that information to every device in your MDM. Okay, and that payload tells the device things like you're a student device or you're a teacher device, and what is the structure of the classes? So which pupils are in which classes? Who are the teachers? And that would be used to configure Apple Classroom automatically for teachers. So teachers in such a situation just install Apple Classroom, hit open, and all the classes are there, and everything just works for them. The problem with that, as we already mentioned, was that almost no MDM vendor supported that. Right, Jamf did a great job, but lots and lots of other MDM vendors just simply do not have support for Apple Classroom, or have only just figured it out now, you know, a year after it came out. So Apple Classroom 2 does is it does a huge big thing where, along with iOS 10.3, you can now create ad hoc, or what Apple calls an unmanaged class, amongst completely unsupervised devices. So you can take an iPad that you bought at retail and meet up with two other friends with retail iPads, no supervision, no MDM, no nothing. One of you installs Apple Classroom. You can create a class right there and you can invite the other people into your class. And you can suddenly be doing Apple Classroom without any support, IT support whatsoever. That's pretty powerful.
Well, I could see this being useful like for seminars, training sessions that you go to, like even like we do as, you know, grown-ups. Like we go to like a, you know, training session for a new software platform. Like I could see this being very useful.
Or any kind of after-school training for teachers or anything like that. Now, of course, one of the things about this is that there are a lot of privacy concerns around this. So if you're a notional student in this scenario, then see, if you were the teacher, Bradley, what you'd have to do is you'd create a class on your device. You'd have to say to me, right, open settings, go into the new section called classroom settings, which only appears if you're close to a teacher device broadcasting a class. But you'd go in there, you'd see the class, you'd tap to join it. And then on your iPad, you've got a 4-digit enroll code. I'd have to put that in on my iPad. And then you would have to accept me into the course. So there's like a kind of handshake process to get students and teachers connected. That's quite elaborate and very hard to do by surprise or by accident, right? It's very hard to trick somebody into doing that because it requires actual verbal interaction between the teacher and the student, and actual positive action on the part of the student to get themselves enrolled in a class. So you are opening up your device to certain control from other devices, but you've done it with what must be your knowing consent, right? Or you've at least been told to do it by somebody.
Can you revoke it later?
Yes, you can. If you're in an unmanaged class, you can delete those classes at any time. And you can also, the classes are persistent though. So once you've joined the class, that class stays there until you delete it. And if, say, I was to come back into your proximity and you were running Apple Classroom with that class open, I would automatically rejoin your class, right? So once the connection is set up, the connection persists there. You can change that so the student can actually say, I only want to join classes manually. So like just if say you happen to be sitting in a lecture room or in a lab where the TA was using Apple Classroom and you had previously joined their class, you could say, I don't want to be in the class until I choose to be in the class. So when the teacher tries to do something to your device, you get a prompt in that situation that says, do you want to join this class? Yes or no? And you can say no, and no actions will be taken on your device. So the student has a lot of control over privacy. As you might expect, because these are unsupervised devices, there's no kind of institutional relationship there. So that's kind of what you would expect to happen. And it is really nicely implemented, though, because only the teacher needs Apple Classroom installed. All the client software is built into iOS 10. The students don't have to install Apple Classroom at all for this to work.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. That's going to make it a lot easier to set up for schools that have MDMs that don't support it.
Yeah, and it is cool for like the one teacher who's into that kind of stuff, you know, in a school where nobody cares. They don't have to like petition somebody to buy an MDM server, and then they've got to set it up as well as all the other things they have to do, you know, all that stuff. A couple other things, right? That infrastructure side is really the big deal for iOS 10.3, I think. But there's a couple of teacher-facing features which are pretty cool. One of which is that when you're looking at a class, there's a button that just lets you mute the sound on every device in your room, which is very welcome. Somebody tweeted at me about this, saying, what about voiceover users? And, you know, if people are sort of vision impaired, then that's really going to screw them over because, you know, they depend on the volume. Turns out that Apple thought about that. And if a student device is using voiceover, mute doesn't work on their device, which is really nice to think about that. And it also gives the teacher a message that says, oh, this one didn't work because voiceover is enabled, so we're not muting that person's device. Because obviously, if you've got voiceover on, you really need voiceover on. I mean, nobody runs it by accident, so that's cool. And the last thing, and this is a big enhancement, is an enhancement to document sharing. So what happens is in Apple Classroom 2, when you open an app, or sorry, when you open a class, that class becomes like the current class, and that sort of permeates out through iOS. So whenever you come to hit the share sheet, whether that be in Safari to share a URL or Pages to share a document or whatever other app you want to share something with, anywhere you get the share sheet, what appears in the share sheet in the first item is the current class in Apple Classroom. So you can hit that button, and then every device that is on and within range in that class will be sent the same item at the same time, which is really cool. That's like a huge improvement on anything we had before.
Yeah, that's this is huge for a 0.3 update, if you think about it. This stuff could have been saved until you know, the fall. It's a recurring theme here, I guess, 2 years in a row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think these are very much education features. They're coming out now. At the time when people are thinking, you know, what's Apple saying about education for the next year? Well, this is what Apple's saying for education for the next year is, number one, everybody come into the management fold. Number two, everybody get a 64-bit device that does all the great features of iOS. And number three, let's all use Apple Classroom.
Well, and
here are different ways to do that. You know,
it's something you can test and roll out for August without having to like roll it out in October when iOS 11 drops.
Yeah, that's, and it lets you also, like, I've been thinking for a while, maybe I should do some training in Apple Classroom or something, and now I will, and now I can, but I can do it like now before teachers go on study leave or holidays or whatever. I don't have to do it like one weekend in October when iOS 11 comes out, you're right. So, yeah, all very cool, and I've been running it for a little while on the beta version, and it's really good, really fast. Seems a bit more reliable in Classroom 1 as well in terms of discovering all the devices. It's working really, really well. So top marks for all that stuff. I think it's a really, I wouldn't say it's a spectacular update, but there were clearly a lot of schools who were facing like really hard walls that they couldn't get past, right? So things like our MDM vendor doesn't support Apple Classroom, or you know, we can't get all our devices into DEP. You know, we've got to live with buying devices from different places. A lot of those walls have now been taken away, and now you can start to do things the way that I get to do them, because I've always been the kind of golden path guy. But now everybody can have these kind of features, and that's super important. I think it's really, really a big deal.
Yeah. So what else we got? Let's see.
iWork.
Also, some, like, those are updates that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, tell us what's in there.
Well, I think one of the things I'd like to say before we get to the list is, you remember, what was it, like 2 years ago, they totally overhauled everything and it was missing a lot of features.
Oh, yeah. The big iWork scandal of, what was it, 2014 or something?
Yeah, something like that. This is why it's paying off now.
Yeah.
And again, those are like painful transitions, but I think this is why it's paying off, because they were able to roll these things, kind of modern things, out onto iOS that are pretty powerful features. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and again, some of these are things that like the Mac could have done for, you know, in the past, but they're finally kind of getting even more parity. Couple things in Numbers, rich text and cells, new editing keyboard, and you can add stock information to spreadsheets. You know, Numbers one of those apps that I don't spend a ton of time in spreadsheets, and when I do, I tend to do more of it in Google Spreadsheets just because it may be something I'm sharing with someone in our domain. But it's mm-hmm. a really beautiful app. It's really, really beautiful, and it's fast.
Yeah, Numbers is kind of like the stepchild of iWork, isn't it? You know, it's Pages and Keynote and Numbers, you know.
Well, I mean,
it has its devotees, you know, but
people that live in spreadsheets are probably using Excel.
Yeah,
I mean, they are. In reality, it's new things in Keynote. You can change the master slide. You can customize slide background. You can add the slide number to any slide. You can change the text background color, and you can also embed interactive presentations on websites. But you know, we kind of can't figure out how to do that just yet. But we're assuming that's coming information that's coming out.
The bullet point is there, but I don't know how to get to that. I don't know if it maybe is just the Keynote on the Mac thing. I'm not sure, but I haven't figured that one out yet.
But that is nice though. I mean, I could see where you might use that in like your internal wiki. Like if you recorded, yeah. If you say recorded something and you could drop it in there, like it's like a little mini WebEx kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then you can rehearse the presentation with the presenter view without connecting to an Apple TV or another third party projector.
Yeah, this is really cool for kids because, you know, when kids want to practice, they don't want to practice looking at their slides. They want to practice looking at the timer and the notes and all that stuff. And what I discovered, like I teach, you know, presentation skills in school. And one of the things I discovered when kids come to present is that they have no idea how to work the presentation view because they never see it until they're actually up on the projector. So this is really cool. And it's going to give kids a lot more chance to get familiar with how to operate the presenter view before they have to finally, you know, present or get a classroom that's empty and get a shot of the Apple TV or something. So, note that you still can't record the rehearsal, which is something you can do in Keynote for the Mac, where it records your slide timings and transitions and also your voice. That would be a great enhancement. I think that's something that would be really cool, particularly for children who have like anxiety problems or something and just cannot get themselves up to like present in front of the class. What a teacher could do is say, right, well, record your presentation and send it to me and I can at least assess part of it, maybe not the whole thing. So hopefully that's the kind of the first step to doing that feature. Which has been available in desktop versions for a long time, but yeah, very, very nice basic updates to Keynote. I think the other thing to say, Bradley, is that the changing the master slide, that's not editing the master slide, it's just changing what type of slide this is after you've started making it. So what it does is it takes you back to the slide picker for your theme and you can choose a different one. But you can't, in PowerPoint style, go into the master slide and put a graphic on the background and put an action button in the corner and all the things that you can do in PowerPoint. It's just going back and choosing a different master for the slide you're already working on.
Lots of good updates here to Keynote. Pages. So we got some very complex ones. Mm. I'll run some of the simpler ones real quick. You can use Touch ID to unlock for password protected documents. And I'll say, like, when you get Touch ID inside of apps, that's fantastic. It just creates a level of simplicity. You know, I think I mentioned earlier about one of the things that's way easier on iOS than it is on macOS is updating your avatar across various websites and apps that you use. And this is kind of making me Touch ID is just a fantastic feature for iOS. And of course, it is on the Mac now, but just in the one model. You can do RTF import and export. So it's rich text format. You can replace missing fonts with Helvetica. And
there's no picker there. It's just, would you like all these fonts to become Helvetica? Yes. You know, previously, it just said, all these fonts are missing, so your document might look different. Okay. But now you can say, replace them with Helvetica, right? You can't choose any other font, but you can at least stop getting that warning every single time you open the document for the rest of your life, which is something I've struggled with a couple of presentations that I've got from other people where they made it on a Mac and sent it to me or something. They put in custom fonts that I don't have. I get that every single time I open their presentation.
Then support for regional formats and currencies and dates. So again, Apple's a very much a worldwide company, and this is one of the ways they keep doing that.
Yeah. And essentially what you can do is at the document level, you can say this document is US or UK or European or whatever, overriding the system settings, which is pretty nice.
So you're going to need to explain to me some of the rest of these updates because I don't understand what they are.
Okay. Two things. The simpler one of the two is that you can now do write superscript and subscript text on iOS, which is something, you know, X squared, right, where the 2 is small and raised above the baseline, or X2, which is the 2 is small and lowered below the baseline. Those are the kind of things you do in like scientific writing quite a lot. And that has been something that has been missing in Pages in iOS since forever, but that's now possible. And the second one is there's now an equation editor which can take, you can paste in either LaTeX or MathML notation. Now, these are two basically like almost HTML-like markup languages. MathML is actually an XML grammar, but LaTeX is an older document layout format that is heavily used for scientific and mathematical academic papers, which not many people are familiar with at all. I'm familiar with it from my days at university because we used it for papers back then because we were like super nerds back in the day. But my math teacher colleague, he told me that there's an app called MyScript MathPad. And this thing is like a piece of magic, right? Because what MyScript MathPad does is you can draw with your finger any equation, right? And it will do handwriting recognition on the equation and it will format it according to, you know, all the rules of mathematics. And then you can copy either the MathML notation for that equation or the LaTeX notation for that equation, and then you can paste it right into the Pages equation editor. So it's really, really cool that you can do that. So even if you're not that sure how to generate LaTeX or MathML, just get that app, MyScript MathPad, draw your equation by hand, copy and paste into the Pages equation editor, and you're off and running. So really nicely done.
Yeah, and these are small improvements that are, you know, nobody's buying a Mac because of this, but it's another reason that you don't have to install Word or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. When you insert the equations into your document, they're basically like inline graphics. So there are graphics that sort of appear in the line of the text, so you can type before them and after them. The one big limitation I've noticed so far is that you can't change the color at all, right? It's black on white. So there's no control for like what color the equation should be or anything like that. You can copy and paste them into Keynote and they go in as a kind of vector graphic, so you can increase the size of them without any problem, put them on your Keynote slide, but you've got to make sure your Keynote appearance is going to match black text on white because you can't change that afterwards. So that's the only big limitation I've found so far, but you know, maybe math teachers might find something else, but I'm pretty impressed with that. That's quite a big feature to get in a point update.
In an app that comes with every device for free.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's another thing to think about when you're talking about the relative cost of different devices is that, you know, all the stuff that we're talking about, I mean, I don't think anything we've mentioned tonight, Bradley, you pay a penny for.
That's impressive. I mean, I will say that is impressive. We were texting about that last week about, like, you know, the things that iOS has built in. Like, what is like one of those things where if someone is iOS only, like what are the third party apps they have to install? You know, and you know this is kind of taking out one of those edge cases.
And the last one, the other redheaded stepchild is iTunes U, which got an update to version 3.5, and it only brings 3 features, right, and not any of the ones that we actually wanted. You know, my wish list for iTunes U includes things like enhancements to the way you write posts in the application, support for Touch ID for teachers, split screen support. These are all the things I want, and none of them came. And instead, what we got is we got the ability to mark up photos using the annotation tools. So in the current version or the previous version, the only thing you could mark up was a PDF document. So if the student sent you a PDF, you could mark it up and send it back. But if they sent you a screenshot, for example, you couldn't draw on the screenshot and send it back. And now you can. The other thing is, when you're doing feedback with students, there's now a button that lets you record a video and send it to the student. It's fine. It's a shortcut button. You know, you've got the each student has got an individual feedback channel in each assignment, and beside the bit where you type, there's now a button where you can record a video. So, fine. And the last one is you can open audio and video files in other apps. Now, I've not quite understood what this is yet, but my guess is that, like, whenever you say I put a video in iTunes U, the only thing a student could do with that is view it right in iTunes U. Whereas I think what this will do now is it gives the students an open in option for those video files so that they could, for example, open it in the Photos application or send it to iMovie, or they could do something else with the video instead of just watching it in iTunes U, which I think is probably helpful for teachers who maybe are doing like media studies or something, where they might want kids to recut a video and they want to distribute the video through iTunes U. But up to now, there's been no way to for the kids to take that video and do something with it. All they've been able to do is just watch it in iTunes U. So breaking that assumption that every video has to be watched in iTunes U is going to be pretty useful for certain kinds of classes. But you know, there's a whole bunch of other features that iTunes U really needs pretty quick that I'm hoping are being worked on.
Here, one thought I had is, does it make sense for iTunes U and Apple Classroom to be separate apps? Could they not be integrated into one?
I think if they were to do that, right? The thing about iTunes U is it's not the only learning management system on the platform, right? And I think what that would do is it would retard the implementation of Apple Classroom, because people are like, well, I've already got Seesaw, or I've already got Shobi, or I've already got Google Classroom. I can't use that because I can't switch to iTunes U. And I think people would get confused about, True. Oh, do I have to switch to iTunes U in order to get those features? So I think they actually serve better being separate applications, because then you can have one without the implication of switching your learning management platform to iTunes U as well. Now, we do use iTunes U, so for us it would make no difference. But for a lot of other schools that use Canvas or Blackboard or something else, I think they would be like, well, forget all that because we're not switching away from Canvas. So they wouldn't get those features. So I think it makes sense for them to be separate for now. And of course, iTunes U is not always going to be the most powerful thing in the world. I mean, there are certainly platforms that do more than iTunes U, but I'm kind of hoping for Apple to keep working on that and keep making it more and more powerful as time goes by as well.
Well, big updates have come, and it's exciting, and we will get back next week to our reasons to deploy discussion, and we'll be hitting iOS. So it was almost good that we saved it for last, because it's the new pricing for the new iPads does certainly change that discussion as well. So thanks, everybody, for listening this week. Thanks to our sponsor, Jamf. You can rate us on iTunes, itunes.com/outofschool. I'd love to connect with you on Twitter, Bradley Chambers, and chambersdaily.com is my blog.
Okay, and I am Fraser Spears on Twitter, and I finally wrote something, right? my last blog post was October 2016. I wrote a blog post this week about what's new in Apple Classroom 2.0. So in a bit more detail, some of the stuff we've talked about tonight, head over to spears.org and you can get a look at that post as well.
Have a good week, everybody.